Hello everyone, how are you all doing? Come on in, sit on down. Welcome to a special call-in show of a live Q&A. Off the cuff, I thought, you know, I haven't got any guests lined up, I've not got any podcast visits this week. Maybe I should make it a little bit more interesting than usual. And let's open up the phone lines and get people on. Just anyone and anyone to come on and share their views on this Millennial Kingdom theory and their ideas. And someone did reach out to me. I have Andy with me on the line. Andy, are you there?
I am Paul. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, so you emailed me maybe a few days ago saying you've been listening to the channel, you've got some thoughts and ideas surrounding the Millennial Kingdom yourself. And I said, you know what, Andy, just come and say it out loud rather than typing it out. Share these ideas with everybody else, because that's kind of what we need to do in this community. You know, I mean, I'm just one man. I do what I can, and I find little bits of information here and there I find interesting, and I share on my channel. But a lot of the stuff, people like yourself, you know, tell me about it, and then I go off and do my own research and see what I can figure out for myself. But I do believe you have a few ideas of your own you want to share. So Andy, do you want to tell the people what you've got on your mind with this theory?
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Firstly, thanks for inviting me on, and
hello to
everyone. This is the first thing for me, so bear with me with this one. I'm originally from England, but I've lived in New Zealand for the last 17-18 years. Grew up with a real passion for history, things that didn't make sense even when I was younger, especially around things like the pyramids. They never made any sense to me, what was actually going on there. And I would say over the last 3 or 4 years, I've woken up a lot. I just took for granted everything I was taught at school, which I think most people probably were of my Gen X. We just got on with it. Mm-hmm. So we didn't think too much about it. But I was fortunate enough to come across your podcast a few days ago, Paul, with Joe, where you were going through Hunter Gunnarsson's around the three strata layers.
Yes.
In history.
That's right.
Yeah. And that made complete sense to me.
Yeah.
Like I grew up near Bath. So we have the Roman baths.
That's right.
Avebury Stone Circle was, I actually lived near Avebury. So I grew up in that sort of area, and things just did not make sense. Like, for example, why did British soldiers apparently topple and knock over and destroy Avebury Stone Circle so long ago? Wasn't a mistake, but for some reason. So my focus has pretty much been around what the hell went on from like 1776 with the American Revolution and then the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that apart from a historical interest, I'm a sports nut. I love sport. So I started thinking about the period from 1776 onwards, and were there any markers or indicators of rules or changes that might have come about during that time? Now, I know a lot of people talk about the amount of inventions, things that were invented during the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a period of thousands of years where nothing was really invented, and then suddenly along comes the 1800s and people start inventing lots of things, but a small amount of people start inventing lots of things at the same time. And then I started looking into sport and the history of sport. And I don't know if I'm 100% correct with this, but my theory is that the predominant sports in the world, so football, cricket, rugby, golf, tennis, badminton, squash, netball, were all invented in the 1800s and were all invented in the UK, which seems a bit strange why one country would invent pretty much the most dominant sports in the world. Mm. And there aren't any from any other parts of the world. America's got American football and baseball, which is a derivative of rounders, which I used to play when I was younger. Same. And Australia's got Australian rules football, but they're derivatives of the same sports. But there are no other sports from any other part of the world that are big, are massively popular on a global scale. So that's one. And an example for me around whether or not we haven't been told the truth is golf. So if the home of golf is in Scotland, and it's a golf course called St. Andrews, and if you look at the clubhouse for St. Andrews, it looks like it's 1,000 years old. It doesn't look new. The architecture is very much in that style of, I wouldn't say it's that basilica style that you talked about in your podcast with Joe, but it doesn't seem to fit right. But equally, there are two parts to this as well. The majority of those sports that were invented in the 1800s, they managed to invent pretty much all of the rules at that time as well. Hardly any rules have changed in the last 100, 150 years. And golf is a classic example. I mean, the golf rule book is, this thick. But equally, the organization that runs golf around the world, except for in America, where there's the PGA, but the golf organization that runs golf worldwide is called the R&A. Now, R&A stands for Royal and Ancient. So if this was a brand new sport, I wonder why it was the rules were referred to, or the governing body was referred to as R&A, Royal and Ancient. It seems a bit of a oxymoron.
It is an odd one, yeah.
It's Royal and Ancient, but it's brand new. Hey, we've just invented this game and we've got a bookload of rules. Anyway, so that's one of my examples from a sporting perspective. But then, obviously, with sport, I love watching football. I love watching World Cups, European football. And at the beginning of every game, the national anthem is played for each of those teams. And so I started thinking, well, when did national anthems get invented? And again, I think that there is a lot of I think there's some evidence that those national anthems were all thought of and written in the 1800s as well. And equally flags, that flags of countries, I can't speak for the rest of the world, but from a European perspective, if you go back and look at pictures, paintings from years ago, it's more localized. So for example, in Spain, you would have had Catalonia, and it would have had a flag, and you would have had Valencia, which had a flag, and I think the British flags were slightly different as well. But then all of a sudden, these countries have got flags,
Interesting.
and they're all just, if you look at how similar they are, like Belgium, for example, with Germany, same three colors, just the other way around.
Yeah, there's a
France,
lot of that with a lot of flags, isn't there?
a lot of flags. So they didn't really come up with many themes around flags, but they do seem to have, a lot seems to have happened in the 1800s, which isn't just about technological advancements that suddenly went through the roof. And the other one that I wanted to mention, which I didn't get the chance to talk to you about, is looking back from very ancient times, they say about how important gold is. It's got like two uses, but it's so important to us. And petroleum oil is known as black gold.
Yes.
So I think that, yeah, that's probably some of the things that, without sounding too crazy, that's some of the
No.
things that I have questions about and I'm not sure about, that I would love to get some feedback from other people, because I just want to keep diving around
Yeah, well,
in this subject.
fortunately, you're in the right place to say such things. No one's going to call you crazy here. Unfortunately, you're talking to somebody who's completely and totally inept when it comes to sports. I know nothing about any sports ball game at all. My dad really tried to get me into football. He tried to make me a Burnley fan. Maybe that was the problem. I don't know. But
Probably.
going to Turf Moor when I was a kid probably gave me a huge sour taste in the mouth, repeatedly watching them lose.
But equally, there's another thing that's quite interesting. interesting, Paul, is that a lot of sports are about an orb or a ball being hit by a stick or a something. And I don't know about that symbolism either.
Well, I feel like I've kind of thought about this before in the past, you know, and I've always had the feeling of I don't understand the appeal to any of these games. The sport, I call them sports ball because you can apply it to any game. It all involves a sport, a ball going into a hole of, or a net or something and getting from ball from point A to point B, and that's the game. And in a way, that's what we call like sports. But you think of something like the Olympic Games. These are more akin to something like a game than a sport, because it's one individual usually showcasing their ability against other individuals to win and come out on top. But sports ball, there is no winner, really, ever. It's a never-ending continuum of charts and leagues and going up and down in divisions, and it's like I look at those things and I can't help but get the feeling of like bread and circus vibes from them. Like, they were created for the specific reason of going on every day for eternity, keeping people trapped within like a system of obsession. And I'm not saying it's bad to be into sports. They're fun and they keep you healthy. I get it, you know, so it's not like degrading them as that, but I do find there is like a cult obsession that gets put around these things sometimes, where people have gone beyond it just being a game and it's now their life, you know. And in that sense, I can't help but feel as a Christian that that's a waste of a life personally, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, if you refer to some of the terminology that's used within sport, especially football, where we talk about supporting a club, and it's tribal. So it is almost a way to build barriers between us in areas. There is a hatred internally within a country from a tribal perspective, and then there is a hatred within countries. So when England, for example, play France or Germany or whoever, there is a hatred from a national perspective. So rather than allowing us to be one and thinking of us all being the same, we are taught that we are different, we are better, or we are we must hate.
Oh,
those
people. The football rivalries are huge in England. For majority American audience, I don't think they truly understand just what it means here. Like, and it's always usually the neighboring town. So for Burnley, for me, it was Blackburn. Sworn enemies, hate each other. And it would be, there'd be a fight every time that one football team would go to the other city. And it'd be like a firm or a group of people who were there just for the fight. You know what I mean? And it's all just because they're playing a game, a sports ball, whatever it is, you know. And our town is not like their town, or there are enemies for whatever undefined reason. But the thing is, then it's on a local level, your local teams, you have something similar, like villages are rivals, and in that sense, and then it fractalizes up to cities, and then it goes up to, well, you don't have county teams, that goes beyond, it's just city teams is all we have in England. But then above that, we'll all unite to be England to go and fight the other country in their team. And that's when we all unify as one for like once every 4 years. It's very odd. But I feel like what it's really doing is it's appealing to a natural desire of man. And I'm talking about men specifically more than women here, to have that tribal identity and culture. It's kind of something we need, in a sense. It creates a cohesion in our minds, a sense of identity and self. And there are healthier ways to do that, I think, than sports. I feel like sports is like the pornography of that kind of realm. It drains that otherwise useful energy towards something completely unproductive. I feel like that's what sports plays, that same role to men. It satisfies a need and a desire that man has to be a part of a bigger thing, a group, and to channel their energy and power towards it, a tribal attitude. But it's wasted energy onto something completely useless that never actually has an end. Yeah. You know, it's an endless cycle of going up in divisions and down in divisions, and never actually, there's no final, they are the winner of football from now on, undisputed, it's over, let's go home. You know, that doesn't exist, does it? And
no, that's right.
The money involved.
But
I
see it moving forward as well. Well, that's an interesting point, the money transfer. The what you were classed as the spectators who go to those sports. You know, we were always told growing up, you know, it's the working man's game, and we pay a fortune for our subscription or for our season ticket. Yeah, the people who play it are multi-millionaires. Yeah. But there's an interesting one around the flags and identity, which is what we've seen an awful lot of in the last 15, 20 years. Flags, identity, how important it is to certain people, those identities and the flags associated with it. And I
Well, a
think
lot of
it's
new flags have been created, haven't they, for specific, not even just countries, ideologies. And the,
yes,
let's
that's
be
what I
let's be
mean.
as vague
You
as we
look at,
can here, because the censors, but we all know what we're saying. A lot of odd-looking flags have appeared in the past, like, few years, you know, 10 years,
yeah,
decade or
correct.
so. I'll let you go,
Yeah,
sorry.
yeah. Yeah, and there's the, yeah, I agree totally. Yeah, there's certainly something around flags and identity. And I think that's where it goes back to the 1800s, I think, is where something started, where there was like, if there was a reset, or if not the reset, but if there was this period of time which is not a good time to be in, then how would people who wanted to make it as horrible and as nasty and as disparate and as people broken up and feeling down, you would do that with classing and classifications of identity. And how would you do that? Well, you would have a flag that people would follow. And I think that it's become, I mean, you only have to look at demonstrations around the world. It's flag centric. It's so flag centric. But there's another port to it as well, which is I was thinking around ideology in the 1800s. Now, isn't that the 1800s where or the late 1700s, early 1800s is where Marx and communism and all of those things came out of like nowhere? It's never been spoken about before. There's nothing from a historical perspective that discusses these different types of political ideologies. And then suddenly there's a control ideology that kicks in that we're taught about. And there's like a fight from one side to the other, you know.
It
Control and
seems like a
ideology
tra a
against.
transfer of power and authority took place in those revolutionary times, and there was a lot of revolution during those times, you know, like the French and the Russian Revolution as well, the end, the destruction of the monarchs, you know, and like the takeover of the people, obviously stirred up through they have more than you have, go get them, you know, go get their stuff,
Yeah, I think that
basically.
was a that was a clear one for the English. People aren't aware as well, the English Civil War. But that's realistically what happened there. It was backed by foreign adversaries who wanted control of England
But
and wanted to take it away from the people.
if you want to do the mainstream understanding, but if let's contextualize this with the possible ending of a millennial reign and the beginning of a little season transfer of power situation, it seems like that's probably how it would realistically go down, isn't it? You have these people who have lived in opulence for 1,000 years of peace, and they've gathered many things in their long life, you know, and they've acquired much land and beautified it and acquired estates, shall we say, and then. I don't know how it pans out, but let's say Satan's released and the Millennial Kingdom has not officially ended necessarily. It wasn't an announcement, but it's kind of now Satan's released. But you will begin to see a decline going the other way. And, you know, could it be that these us against them class differences, border divisions were starting to be created? It's kind of the haves and the have-nots ideologies were starting to be created. And those who had things were likely those who had the land, had the estates, had the buildings, had the money and the wealth and the opulence and so forth, and the health as well, you know. And it's that's you know, the asylums coming up, people being locked away, orphans being suddenly appearing everywhere. And we've tried to figure out, well, is this just because of people were being removed and people being left parentless, children being left parentless because they were the ones who lived through the reign and they just got locked away in asylums, you know, like kept out of the sight and their children redistributed? Or are we talking about a mass influx of people being resurrected or the dead being resurrected again from a biblical standpoint? And suddenly there's just people everywhere and it's kind of the Satan's minions were waiting there to rally them all together and then say, you see all those rich people over there? You know, it's kind of using the scarcity that would suddenly be about due to a mass influx of population out of nowhere. It's kind of, well, now we need to take this land off the rich people and you need to take it back for yourself. And their systems are an old system of an older time where they, you know, they had less people, and now it's kind of they need to share their wealth because there's more people now. And you imagine these type of ideologies would start to ferment in a Little Caesars scenario, or at least someone would be on the shoulders of people whispering in their ears, trying to make them feel this way.
Absolutely. You know? And well, we're also taught that 1,000-year period wasn't peaceful.
No.
If you look back, we're told France and England were at war for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And there's some very strange stuff around battles as mm-hmm. well. Like, you and I will both know the story of the Battle of Hastings mm-hmm. in 1066.
That's right.
I think it was on the 14th of November, 1066, that King Harold fought William the Conqueror from France.
Mm-hmm. The Norman days, that was the Norman invasion after the Saxons, we're told about 400, 500 years after the Saxons is when the Norman invasion happened, something like that.
But we're also taught in history that 18 days earlier, 400 miles away, he fought the Viking leader, Harald Hardrada.
Mm-hmm. Same name, basically. It starts to get dodgy. Did you see what I saw in the presentation about King Arthur being a pre-first century king who was actually trying to fight off the Saxon invasion, which was all happening in the first century with the Roman invasion as well. It was just an absolute mess of chaos. And
I think I remember hearing someone say, if they dismiss it or it seems unbelievable, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So if someone in history says, no, that didn't happen, it probably did. And if you reverse engineer history and thought, mm-hmm. things start to make sense.
Well, absolutely. Well, like I said, this 1066, this 1066 date, if we're going to remove 700 years, you know, then really it's 300, it's something like that, roughly, of the first century. You know, we're not actually that far into the first millennium at all. We're told it was like the 10th, 9th century, there was some kind of Christian revival, we're told. You know, monasteries happening and all these type of things.
The Age of Enlightenment. What it's called.
Something like that. Yeah, coming kind of like the late Middle Ages. Then as we had like a 500-year period after that where things started to shift towards anti-religious sentiments, enlightenment sentiments, reason, logic sentiment, philosophy sentiment. That's when all these strange new things started to appear, you know, the Copernican model and all these type of things. It's kind of all started to happen maybe around the 1600s. And that's really where we start to get much documented history as well. Like more so documented memoirs and things like this. There's just more volumes of stuff to read. In the past, there were things we could kind of infer from letters and whatever we could find, but it's kind of, there wasn't much. There was a lot of guesswork to fill in those gaps prior to like the 1500s. Even when I did my own research for the Nephilim Clown book, it's kind of like I can't find much real information on the traveling troupe of the Comédie de l'Arts until about the 1500s. When suddenly you know everything about them, but you're told, oh, they've been traveling around for 1,000 years, and that's kind of all you know. It's kind of, well, what were they doing for those 1,000 years exactly? Like, do we have any evidence of we have very loose evidence mentioning them here and there, but it's kind of we just use our imagination for the rest. And that's pretty much what most of history has been. It's somebody's imagination to kind of come up with the gaps, and as a result added time was included, and different names for the same events was included. And even then I'm saying this, even the records we have for like the 1700s, 1800s, the genealogies are an absolute nightmare to sift through, because every father named all of their sons the same name, his name, so you don't know who you're talking about at any given moment, or who married who, because everyone's got the same name apparently. And it's kind of like you have to wonder if they even existed, half of these people they're talking about, because even I have this odd story that I found. So there's this guy called Richard Hughes in the 1800s, late 1700s, early 1800s, and he owns Sadler's Wells Theatre, in London. And he just owns it. He hires people to run it, but he's the wealthy, rich business aristocrat type guy who just owns and reaps all the benefits and pays his people, you know. And it's said that I figured it out. Basically, his daughter died on her deathbed, Maria Hughes, who was married to a guy called Joseph Grimaldi, who worked as an actor in the theatre. She died on her deathbed giving birth. While giving birth. So on her deathbed, she says her brother, Richard Hughes, is how it's documented. But there's no evidence of her brother anywhere else other than this random document. The only Richard Hughes I'm aware of is her father. For some reason, she tells her brother, look after poor Joe. Why would her brother have anything to do with looking after Joseph Grimaldi when it was her father, Richard Hughes, who had hired the man and was paying him? It is kind of clearly she said it to her father, but the historical record says she told her brother, who had the same name. And this is where things get really complicated. You try and find the family trees, and you can't really go much further back than the 1800s. You really can't. Like,
no, you can't. No, I mean, if you go on to, you know, if you believe Ancestry.com and that it's not a DNA collection site,
no,
and you're getting the right information back, then yeah, you're right. I mean, I can go back to my great grandfather fought at Waterloo, and that's as far back, and there are military records for that, but you can't go back. I don't know who his father was, but that was one. DNA and was something that also sparked a query for me, obviously coming from England. I've got lots of mates who I grew up with, and none of us have got Italian DNA. Like, none of us. We've got Icelandic, Norse, Norwegian, but no Italian. So, and I think this goes back to the point in the conversation before about the Roman Empire using armies from closer to where they wanted to conquer. Otherwise, a lot of us would have what we call Latin DNA or Italian DNA. Well, I've got none. I don't know anyone who has. Again, that might be just because of a part of England that I grew up in. But it does seem, you know, it does seem very strange. And some of the stories from that period as well are, you know, the massacring of the Druids on Anglesey and wiping out the history. You never know what's real and what isn't. So my journey is certainly coming to the point where I'm questioning so much around everything, really, and trying to get my head around it. But yeah, the things that I mentioned around sport and those key indicators, they are almost indicators. It's almost like if we are in what I call the silly season, then they can't lie, and there's symbolism, and they love to tell us what is really going on. And I think a lot of that is symbolism around flags, sport, anthems, chanting. An anthem is literally chanting. It's chanting to music and making everyone say and believe the same thing. And if you can do that on a national scale, like God save the king or send him victorious, it's brainwashing in effect. It's just believe this, follow this flag, follow this, don't question, follow. And a lot of people have done that, especially with the wars that we've had over the last 250 years. I mean,
I feel like it's a bit of an archaic method today of brainwashing compared to what we're up against nowadays with brainwashing techniques. But it probably
worked. We're on brainwashing 2.0, right?
Yeah, I bet it worked really well though when there wasn't TV and radio or whatever methods of communication there was. You had the anthems, you had the flags, you had the pledging allegiance type of thing. You had all this idea of, you know, one nation under one flag type of ideology. The us against them, you know, and not to mention the fog of war that was around then before the communication systems. It really was more of an isolation type situation, especially during a time of revolution where your country could just be invaded at any moment. I think a lot of this fear that was generated in the early stages of, let's say, the Little Season, that galvanizing around the image of your nation, you know, an idol, essentially, is probably the first method used in the early stages to separate people from one another and make them start to forget. Because during times of war and revolution, you tend to prioritize things, and remembering your history isn't one of them, or learning history, these type of things, or art, you know, and appreciating the things that were documented in books, that kind of starts to get put to one side and everyone kind of gets geared into survival mode. A method we've seen used against us over and over again. But sorry, go on.
Yeah, Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things I was going to mention was around how wars are formed and who's involved. You know, for example, civil wars, just lots of civil wars, one side against the other in a country, which just seems quite bizarre as well. And so often, you know, you can call the French Revolution the Civil War. I mean, which pretty much so American Revolution. And an American Civil War, all within the space of less than 100 years. So we're told that they were happy and they got independence from Britain, but then they decided to have a massive war against each other. And so we have those wars that keep putting people against people, and the military industrial complex can basically fund both sides, and just keeps making more and more and more money, but also more. Just makes people feel sad, and there's no end to this ongoing identity. You're one or you're the other. I did see a very interesting, it was a pictorial of the United States, and from a Democratic and a Republican perspective. And I think back in the 1930s, 1940s, when people were questioned around what they believed and what they had in common, the Democrats and Republicans were kind of like this. But now they're here. Sorry. Now they have nothing. It's like, well, it's not a weird hand
You
signal,
satanic
but
shill.
I know. But they have
I've been
nothing
there,
in
don't worry
common.
about it.
You know what I mean? There's nothing in common between the two. Now, in New Zealand, we have the same. For the people who aren't aware of New Zealand, we have real issues at the moment with indigenous and ideology and land, and it's not yours, and leave, and don't be here, and you've killed everyone. And it's the animosity between groups, and you can see it clearly with, I think you can see it in Europe. You can certainly see it in the UK. It doesn't matter what happens. People who support one group don't care, the other group get called something else. You can see it in America as well. It's Again, it is pulling people apart rather than people just realizing that we're not each other's enemy. There is a greater enemy that is got the strings, that's playing the puppet above and laughing whilst we constantly don't wake up. I think that's,
Well, I
yeah.
think chaos is the name of the game. They want to Order out of chaos is the motto, you know, and they have purposely created dividing lines between us, done everything they can to push us away from each other, and literally wherever there's a dichotomy, they've put a wedge between it. It doesn't matter where it is, and on the scale of this country versus that country, or even just on the simple of man versus woman, it doesn't matter what level they've wherever there's an opposites of sorts or a spectrum, they've push them further apart from each other and made them alien to one another as much as they possibly can. And I think that the idea is they want to foment basically insanity and depression among the populace. So they would need a solution. They'll crave change and something different. And going back to this early stages, you're talking about revolutions and then civil wars. It seems like every one of these was a step towards where we are today, because it was always a revolution against an ideology or a concept. Religion, church and state, these type of things, you know, monarchies. It was revolutions against the established norms that would have been normal during a millennial reign. That was the revolution, the first revolution. And then civil war comes after the initial revolution, where you abandon the moral standard, and then it's separation from within. So a kingdom within, you know, divided can't stand to have it. Then it seems like the next method is now we need to separate that country between a left and right paradigm of some kind. And it's always on a moral issue again.
Correct.
Slavery, you know, something like slavery or these concepts. Because what they want to do is prep this idea for today, where it's like, okay, reparations. It's like a future forward plan. You know what I mean? They want to try and create this dichotomy where how could we prolong the pain and suffering for as many centuries as possible after this civil war? And it's kind of, we're laying the foundations for the new ideology we want to create in the future, way in the future. So these are future planners. If we start this war now, then in the year 2000, we can start fomenting racial wars then. It's kind of, we can. Always long-term planning. I think that's how it's all. And all these early big civil wars, they seem organic to us in the history books, but I think this is a long playbook, a long con. I think they we need the war now for the plan in the future towards the end of the little season. So yeah, because yep, then we correct. Can initiate the New Age ideologies, the indigenous ideology stuff, the all these type of things, the rainbow multicolored collective ideologies can all start to be implemented now. And this is late end stage degradation of morality stage of the plan. Like, we're at the point now where we are so far removed from these standards of morality and what a kingdom is and what it means to have a monarch or what it means to have the church involved in daily life. All that's just been removed from us now. But those wars were necessary to destroy the foundation, and then it's just been crumbling ever since. I think that was the whole point, to get us to this point. Because then now people are postmodern and they're apathetic, and everything has to be deconstructed and everything has to be reorganized. And now they're building out of the ashes the Phoenix, which is going to be the one world nation army to make war with Gog, with the Camp of Saints whenever that comes around, if it's the little season. Yep. But to get to that point and to get everyone on board with the same idea, they've all had to just...
Well, I think that's where some of those things are quite interesting around a one world army.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that. I mean, you can see, you can question, not see. You mm-hmm. can question why there's so many military age men are being pumped into Europe and into America.
Mm-hmm.
Because men take their families, their children and their wives to escape conflict, but they go to war with their mates.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something around a one world army? Like, we have to control this. And then it does that then bring in the concept of an AI generated alien attack,
which something like that, again. Yeah.
But they want which to, is what they're talking about.
It is what they're talking about. They're even talking about it in like the Pentagon recently, aren't they? And the UFO sightings.
Absolutely.
And they're making a public spectacle of it because they want people to be prepped for that inevitability. In terms of like,
so if there borders, is a terminology of the Lord coming back, and it's coming down,
mm-hmm.
yet they can sell it that it's an alien attack, and we've got a one world army, and don't worry.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. I mean, I think the whole idea, you know, they had these flags and borders, and they've only strengthened the national identity thing all throughout, let's say, the 1800s to now. I think what they've done is they've taken it to such extremes that people are now like, borders are silly. They only cause more problems than good. Let's just get rid of them. So it's kind of, they purposely exacerbated the worst case scenario of borders and countries and flags to make people sick of it, to the point where they want the opposite. So it's all like, it's a long-term plan, you know, but it's kind of like...
Yeah, and I think you can see that from slavery, for example. So there's such a focus on one specific slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the same time, for example, the Ottoman Empire, I mean, there's roughly 17 million
mm-hmm.
Africans were removed as part of the Ottoman slavery. But no one talks about that. There's
and Slavs and Slavic people.
It's where slave comes from. It's Slavic. Mm. So if you talk about the Barbary pirates, but what I was trying to explain there was, I mean, I clearly have the conversation because I'm in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this concept over here of colonization and everything else. But when you talk about another example, no one wants to carry on that conversation. So here's the classic is the Atlantic slave trade,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the Ottoman Empire slave trade. One is terrible and awful and needs to be settled and apologies given. The other one, no one wants to talk about.
And is kind of still happening. So it's kind of...
Yes, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that from an identity politics perspective, it's concentrate on one group that you... But forget about everyone else who's done anything bad. Mm-hmm. Just concentrate this side. So that's where it's become. And then you fuel resentment both sides.
Mm-hmm.
When I went as growing up with history and what I was told, you're like, do we really do that? That's awful.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I've learned, the more I look at it and go, don't look at me like that. Like I was a slave owner and
mm-hmm.
my family were as poor as anything. So again, it's that counter, the pivot of dislike both ways.
Well, you have to remember it was during the 1800 periods, late 1780, it was when Britain was really expanding its empire. And they were colonizing India during that time as well, with the East India Company. Although they said it was like a company that was set, a separate entity from the government, but it was really working.
But really happen? You know what I mean? From what we're told with history, did it really happen?
Because, I don't know. I mean, this is relatively new history.
You know, we colonized. You know? We use the term colonized, but we left.
Yeah.
There's no one in it. British people are not in India.
Mm-hmm.
But we went 15,000 British troops subjugated a population of hundreds of millions. The odds of taking that on and winning, I mean, Alexander the Great apparently never got through India because of the Khans, but 15,000 British troops, well, they weren't the East India Company, they were conscript troops. They conquered India.
Well,
it doesn't make sense in my mind.
Maybe it has something to do with advancements in technology and weaponry as well. That may have changed the tides of war. If you want to say it's true or not, whether it actually happened. And who knows? It may have been more of a case of these are just stories come up after the fact to explain why British people were even in India to begin with. Maybe because the world was a one world system with the 1,000-year reign of Christ. There was already freedom of movement and there wasn't really a problem of borders.
And we have the same here, in Australia and New Zealand. There are buildings here
that shouldn't be there.
That you're like, yeah. Nah. And we have, you know, there are areas in the north of the North Island, that they're like pyramids, but you're not allowed to talk about them and you're not allowed to go near them or excavate or do anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You can't go. And so there's, again, that's that question. I'm going to have to go.
I know you've got to get to work. Thanks for coming on, Andy, and sharing your thoughts. That's what this call-in's for. It's been great talking to you.
And you, Paul. Thanks very much.
No problem. Right. Speak to you soon. Okay. Bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There we go, guys. That was Andy to share his thoughts on flags, national anthems, the invention of sports all around the 1800s. Was our history really true when it comes to any of it from that time period? Or is it all just been completely fabricated to cover up the time that was there prior to the 1800s? I mean, I was talking about 700 years being cut out of, let's say, you know, the first millennium in that last presentation with JT. But it's possible that more time was removed or elongated or changed with the Gregorian calendar in the 13th century as well, that maybe it wasn't that long, really, since the millennial reign ended, and what we call the 1700s might even be 1000, you know, the first millennium after the millennial reign of Christ, after 70 AD. Who knows? Interesting thoughts, though, and that was a great call. I really appreciate him doing that for me. I do have another caller semi-lined up. Let me just very quickly get this arranged. Let me just sort all this out, and I'll stop sharing the screen with you guys. We'll switch to webcam. There we go. And I'm just going to send this link to the next caller, and we'll wait for them to get on. But yeah, guys, did you like that? Let me know in the chat if that was good. Let's give a round of applause to Andy for coming on. That was his first time speaking publicly, and you know it can be nerve-wracking. So I think he did a great job. I think he did really well for his first go. Well done, Andy. Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate that. So let's just quickly go to my emails, and I'll send that out to the next person. Okay, they haven't emailed me those details, but I am talking to them on Telegram, so I'll send them the link there instead. So where are we? Ah, she sent them on Telegram. Great. So, Nicolette, I am about to send you the link on Telegram. If you click that link, it should take you to a browser version of Zoom where you may need to make a quick name or something, but you shouldn't need much just to log on, really. It should be quite straightforward. While you're figuring that out, I will admit you in once it comes up. But you have sent some pictures across for me to share as well about this. And yeah. It should be a good talk, this one. I'm looking forward to it. Let me just quickly check my emails. I think somebody else has reached out to me saying they want to call in as well. I've got Chris here who would love to come on and talk. Here's a theory of mine. Okay, so he's got a few things to talk about there, a few interesting. Chris, if you would like to come on as well, just send me an email saying you can do that. Maybe in the next half hour or so, we'll let Nicolette give her little presentation, and then we'll close it with you for half an hour to give your presentation as well. Does that sound all right, Chris? Let me know in the email. Just send me a quick, yep, that's cool, and I'll send you the link when you're ready. And we'll have a back and forth, have a bit of a conversation. It's always a bit fast and loose, these call-ins. I'm not going to lie. I'm winging it, which I pretty much do for everything in my life. I wing it all. Pearl says, that was dope, Andy. Surprised that this is his first time. He seemed professional. He seemed like he had his stuff together there, and I'm quite impressed. It was a good conversation. That's the core message of Paul's book, says Drunk Wedding Photographer. It had not been for colonization, we'd still be sacrificing our slaves so it rains tomorrow. I don't know if that was the core message of my book necessarily, but there's a lot of evidence to say that the Nephilim had huge influence over ancient cultures, and a lot of the practices you see from a lot of these ancestor spirit worship cultures were certainly inspired by communication with or veneration of the Nephilim in some way, in spirit form or physical form, certainly. People are arguing about something. I don't know. Keep swallowing the given narrative. There's a lot of nuance, but that's a gross overstatement. Just off to work. What I miss? Low joke. God bless us, Miles. you've missed about an hour, Miles. We've missed a call in there from Andy. What's it been? 14, 50 minutes. Not too bad. So let me just check Zoom, see if this is working. Ah, I think our second caller is here. Nicolette. She's just joining. Audio's just connecting. I'll share the screen. Let's close this. Can you hear me there, Nicolette? Nope. Let's try again. Okay, can you hear me? Are we there? Any sound at all coming through? Still connecting audio. Not sure if you can hear me or not, Nicolette, but you may need to just go into the audio settings in the bottom left corner and select the correct microphone. It may be trying to connect through your headphones if you have those connected. You may need to connect it to whichever one you want to use, but they should have many options there. Nothing yet. I can't hear you. If you want to just go back in and come back in, maybe. I can't hear what you're saying. You may need to select the correct microphone in the bottom left corner. So, yeah, in the bottom left corner, the audio, there's an arrow you can click and you can select the microphone. But we have no sound for now. Connecting audio. It says it was connected. Have we got anything? Nothing. No. Do you have maybe a pair of headphones that have one of these speakers in them? That could work if you have one of those. And that shouldn't come up. We'll figure this out, guys. Don't worry. In the meantime, let's check out the chat. If you want to perhaps... Oh, I hear something.
Can you hear me now?
There you are. You're with us. Loud and clear.
Okay. My microphone isn't working, so I'm just having to use my laptop sound.
It sounds good. It sounds clear to me.
Okay. Well, that's good. I don't know why that's not working. Sorry about that.
It's okay. These things happen. We're doing it live, so I expect some issues. For instance, I realize I'm still wearing a sticker my son gave me this afternoon, so I'm going to quickly take that off.
Oh, well, that's cute.
Yeah, so you sent me a long message saying you've got quite a few interesting things to share, some ideas around this theory. So, Nicolette, take it away. Share your ideas.
Yeah, certainly. As far as I know you do a lot of discussion around the millennial reign and the architecture thereof. Now that I see it, I can't unsee it. I see it everywhere. Yeah. I'm sure you see it more being over in in Europe, and I am in Florida. So not as much, but I still can even catch glimpses of it around here. But I thought, a lot of our ideas there, there are some physical evidences. But I mean, the biggest evidence is definitely the architecture and these grand churches. So I was trying to think what would be the best, evidence that we can put forth that's more physical to prove that those are more millennial reign structures. Because I think a lot of people aren't completely sold on that idea. And there's different reasons for that. But my main theory was just that if you could take photos of the architecture in all these churches around the world, because these grand cathedrals and these churches are everywhere, as you know. And a lot of them have pictures of the glorified saints as well as Jesus with different scenes of biblical history. And they all have the lighted halo kind of effect showing that they're all glorified. And so, I mean, according to our history and what they tell us, the first Christian church wasn't even built into the 3rd century BC or AD. So we're supposed to believe that that whole time, no one built a church until the 3rd century. No one in the 1st century did. So these were built after, according to them, all these people would have been long deceased. So, a lot of these churches, they date from the 3rd century all the way up to the 7th century. So that's a pretty good time span there of the buildings of these cathedrals and these church buildings, which all have, as you know, very similar architectural styles to them. They're also spread over, basically the whole world. Of course, there's more over in like Europe, and I've actually had the pleasure of seeing some myself in Germany, which were the most breathtaking buildings I have ever seen in my entire life. But my theory was because they all have these depictions of the apostles, mainly the 12, disciples of Jesus and himself, was if you could go through pictures of these churches, because a lot of them are have these pictures online that you can go through of people who have photographed these buildings and take pictures of the depictions of the disciples and compare them. Because according to the narrative we're given, people built these churches and came up with these depictions just using their imagination, and I mean, really, these depictions of the disciples and Jesus don't look like the typical Middle Eastern man, like we're told where they would have been from anyway. So, if I was to use my imagination and draw just 12 pictures, and then of course of Jesus, so 13 of just Middle Eastern men to symbolically represent these guys, then every one of these churches' depictions would look different. Especially over different time periods and over different continents, there's no way they would all look the same. But of course, they do look the same. And you can go through, again, these different locations and look at these old church buildings over different time periods and pull up pictures. And a lot of them have the names. They'll say Saint Peter or Saint John, and they say who they are. And then the ones that don't name them, by referencing the others, you can figure out who it is. But the 12 disciples specifically and Jesus all have very specific styles as far as they all have similar, the same hair color, and they all have their features. And so it's like, what other possibility is there except that obviously these saints were on the earth physically ruling and reigning with Christ, and people saw them and then depicted them, whether it was, mosaics like the Byzantine style. Some are the paintings in the domes of the churches. Some are sculpted in the rocks or wood. So there's all different types of these depictions, but they all look the same. So if you pull up one that says John, and then you go through all these churches looking at these pictures, you can easily say, okay, well, that's John, and that's John, just based off. They all look the same. And so to me, that's pretty good evidence on how else can you explain that fact?
Yeah, I'm showing the pictures you sent me now, the three you sent, where you've kind of compiled all these images of, let's say, Peter is the first one, which is on the screen now. And obviously, these are like from cathedrals separated by thousands of miles in different countries, all with their own depictions of the saints. But when it comes to each individual saint, they all know what they looked like. It's all the same image of the saint. Now, to try and rationalize this, you could say the artist took inspiration from another cathedral and copied what he saw, maybe, or something like that.
Of course, there's churches. Some of these were in South America, and then the other ones were in England or in Europe somewhere. They supposedly didn't have communication in the 3rd century when some of these were built.
Well, that's it. Absolutely, but it's the end. It begs the question: it can't have been the 3rd century if they all knew what this person looked like, because it had been hundreds of years. And last I checked, in the 1st century, people weren't getting their portraits done very often. I don't think it was looks weren't exactly documented or even that important necessarily. You know, brief descriptions were often given in, like, let's say, birth records for Roman records, perhaps. But it wasn't really something people cared much about, I suppose, unless you were maybe depicting a Caesar of some kind or a leader of some kind. But this is really good evidence that you've got here. I'm quite impressed, to be honest. I never thought about this angle. So when you mentioned it to me on the Telegram, I was like, yeah, come on and show what you've got. It's a good point, isn't it? It's a very good point.
Yeah, and this is just a very brief compilation of what I sent you, but I mean, you can do this for all the all the disciples. There's even some churches near me in downtown Orlando that are that Byzantine look, and I went and toured them myself a few weeks ago, walked around and took pictures of the disciple depictions, and I can point them out now. I don't even need the names beside them. I can go, that's John, that's Peter, that, and there's again no rational explanation except like you said, I doubt their portraits would have been preserved until the 3rd century when they finally started doing these. And then again, even if that was in the location where they lived, how did some of these get over here to South America and some of those churches where these depictions are? So there just is no rational explanation except that this is millennial reign architecture, and they could physically see, these disciples, and that's why they all have similar characteristics of their individual looks. So, yeah, I think that's pretty good evidence, and or in my opinion, almost irrefutable evidence.
Maybe irrefutable is a strong word,
It
but yes,
is.
it's definitely compelling.
It is.
But the thing is, these cathedrals that you see, and any well, not even. These are built in a new style, so not Basilica style. We're talking about Millennial Kingdom Gothic, very unique style of architecture. Like I said, when you see one for yourself, there's nothing like it. Like, you look at these things and you're in awe. Like, you probably were in Germany looking at all the you can't look down a street in anywhere in Germany without seeing something like this. And it's very similar in England as well, and it's very similar anywhere in Europe. But it's kind of, they're all named after saints specifically, very specific saints. And you have to wonder, like, why? Like, necessarily. I mean, I kind of you can kind of humor why, but it's kind of, why not call it the city's cathedral, or the cathedral of wherever, the cathedral of Hamburg, or the cathedral of something? Why does it have to be Saint Paul's Cathedral or Saint Peter's Cathedral specifically every time? And it's maybe it is because they were there overseeing the construction of the thing, and the guy was like, do you want to pose for this stained glass window I'm about to start painting over here, or something like that? We can only speculate. Who actually knows? I mean, I don't know,
Absolutely.
but it does. These cathedrals are something else. And again, I've seen much of this artwork in ones where I stood in Lincoln as well. It's the same thing. They have a very distinct look about them. Each one is a character, and it's you get these stories from Lincoln where they're talking about pilgrimages being made to this one specific cathedral all across the UK, and they can trace the path people followed. And it's like, it's a big deal to make a huge journey on foot over 1,000 miles just to see a building. And you have to wonder, was it really the building that we're going to see? Like, I do wonder this story. It's like, was perhaps maybe a particular person there they needed to see that maybe would have been quite useful, you know, like maybe a saint or something, someone who can help them out with something or intercede on behalf of Jesus for them over something. I don't know, because like no one makes those pilgrimages anymore. Like it seems like a very much a medieval thing to do. And it's kind of like, why would people travel thousands of miles just to see a building? Like when you look at England, there's loads of them. They're everywhere. You don't have to travel far to get to one. Do you get what I mean? But it's like this one in particular seemed of utmost importance for some reason on the way up to York as well, where York Minster is. And it's kind of at, they say it's something to do with kings or something. Okay, but it doesn't seem likely to me. I think we're missing a piece of the puzzle here. And the idea of literal resurrected saints walking around is an incredible thought, isn't it? It's a contested thought. You know, not everyone in the Little Caesar community believes necessarily that was the case. A lot of them, some people think it was just all spiritual in nature. And what do you stand on? Do you think literal saints were walking around? Is that your...
Absolutely. I think that was the whole point of the first resurrection, was you resurrect, you live again bodily.
In a body.
Especially if Christ had already, you know... defeated death and saved the righteous from Sheol and the harrowing of hell and taken them all to, you know, New Jerusalem, paradise, whatever you want to call it. Then when they died, they would have been there, but it says they were resurrected. So to me, they were already there. If they're being resurrected, it's on the earth. So I agree. I think they were bodily here, whether Jesus was walking around or if he kind of stayed in New Jerusalem. I know people have different ideas on if Jesus was physically here. Personally, I think there's a lot of scripture that says he was reigning from Mount Zion, New Jerusalem in the north. So I think he was there. And as we know, people were having to make the pilgrimage, all the different nations. So, I mean, I believe that's what they were doing, was going to see him. As far as the saints and, you know, how that was divided, you know, we can only speculate. But yeah, I do find it funny that all these cathedrals are named after specific saints, and the depictions are so uniform throughout. One other interesting thing that I've noticed since studying this is that all these cathedrals, again, all over the world, have what they call medieval Latin. So all the inscriptions are in Latin. So I remember finding that weird when I went to Germany, looking in these cathedrals, the inscriptions aren't in German, they're in Latin. So, I mean, that makes me to believe that potentially the whole world was speaking Latin during the millennial reign, because again, even the churches in South America and here, they're all inscripted with Latin. So, not to mention, a weird thing is that it's not exactly the Latin that we have today, and it's extremely, extremely difficult to translate. And of course, Google Translate doesn't really translate Latin very well, or ChatGPT or any of these things. I'm able to translate certain phrases, and the certain phrases I am able to translate in these inscriptions, I'll talk about that. Of Christ and his reign. And so, I mean, I even think the inscriptions are pretty good evidence if you're able to translate them. But of course, they make it very challenging to do so.
Well, was it Gunnar Heinsen in that presentation? He was saying that the Latin, the first century Latin, was identical to the Latin inscripted on supposed 10th century buildings and basilicas. It hadn't changed. The language had been preserved perfectly. So maybe it is that first century Latin that you're talking about there. And maybe it's kind of nothing did really change for 1,000 years in terms of what language
that,
it would use.
That whole time they spoke it. But now we can't translate it. Now it's very difficult all of a sudden. So it was preserved that whole time. And now it's challenging. It's almost like they don't want us to translate all of these things. But yeah, that's my theory, just because, again, if this wasn't during the millennial reign when these buildings were made and each nation had their individual language, wouldn't they be making the inscriptions in languages that their people could read?
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? But everything's all up in the air now. You say you're from Florida, is that correct?
I am, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about old world Florida out there. You know, I think, is it Professor Marco Longo? Is that his name? I probably got it horribly wrong there. I think there's these ideas going around that, is it that Eden or something is originally in Florida, or Florida was Jerusalem or something like that? I think there's this big thing going around that it was the promised land originally or something like that. Have you heard that idea before? Anything knocking about? Have you ever considered those
things? No, I don't personally think it's that great here. So
well, maybe not anymore. That's the thing, you know. Yeah. But I think there's something to do with native tribes that practically speak Hebrew or something like that is one of the arguments. So this,
I have seen some of that. Yes, there are some native Hebrew speaking tribes on the coast.
Interesting.
So,
interesting.
I have watched some documentaries on that specifically.
I don't know if there's any validity to that, but I was talking with E. Joyce, Elizabeth Joyce. She's one of the regulars on the Telegram, and her artwork is behind me. She did this here, and she's going to come on soon and share some of her own stuff about walls, and particularly dry brick walls. And these are like, typically farmland has been divided by these walls made of stones stacked on top of each other. But there's like hundreds of thousands of kilometers worth of these things scattered all throughout New England, she's saying. And even in England, where I live, in specifically on the northwestern coastlines and just a bit inland all the way to Scotland and Ireland, we have the exact same stone walls. They're identical. And they're made of slate and many other things, similar materials. And they're stacked in the same design in the same way. And it's kind of, they're in places so odd. It's like, who would have the strength and the willpower and the reasoning, for example, to put one of those walls in that particular spot? So it's like in the middle of a dense forest, at the edge of like a huge drop, dividing, you see this wall of bricks kind of like looping over uneven ground, just kind of dividing this forest in half for no reason whatsoever. And it's kind of like, who built that? Who took the time to carry all those stones up there and do that and stack them, for example, and do it for hundreds of miles? It's kind of, none of it makes any sense. But when you notice that in the New England coastline in Maine, it's identical to England, and it's kind of the same pattern, same stonework, is it possible that before tribulation they were connected? England was actually a part of New England, shall we say? And the only reason we've separated them now, and it's kind of, you're just seeing like remains of whatever was built there prior, before the complete and utter total destruction of the earth during tribulation, which may have literally separated places away from each other. So Florida, for example, might be very well connected to Europe originally, because if you bring the places together, because obviously, quite famously, South America looks like it fits perfectly into Africa, that little groove in Africa. And it's like, they were clearly one place at one point. The Pangaea is kind of the argument for it. I'm wondering if Florida itself was connected to Europe, maybe Portugal or Spain, or somewhere in that inlet. And you say this architecture is everywhere and has no business being everywhere, but it is. Could that be an explanation as to why? They were quite literally, Europe was the hub in the middle, and going out from that, radiating out from that, was all this architecture. And now it's in places like South America for some reason, but it was because it was originally part of the same land area. I don't know, have you thought about that idea? Do you have any ideas you want to?
Absolutely. It does seem the most condensed in Europe. And then it kind of, feathers out from there. But yes, I do believe in the Pangaea, not how we're taught over millions of years, the tectonic plate shift. I think they had to come up with a reason for why everything does look like a puzzle. So they had to give a scientific explanation. But I know I watched Jason Jack, is that his name?
Yes.
I've watched his Pangaea video that he did, which I thought was awesome. I agree. I think everything was connected at one point. Specifically on, even on old maps where the terrain looked much different than it does now. And of course, there's many scriptures that talk about in the day of the Lord that the islands fled away. Jerusalem was broken into three. So I think there's a lot of scriptural references for that too. But yeah, there's no business having some of these church buildings in downtown Orlando. And then you have these, gray rectangular buildings all around it. It just looks so out of place. It boggles the mind. No one in their right mind would have put that there in the middle of nowhere. But it does make sense if it had been connected to other civilization, because Florida is kind of a weird shaped landmass just in general. So,
Yeah, well, I've been to Florida. I went to Florida at the start of the year, in Orlando, and it's vast and dry, and when it rains, it rains. It's a very diverse landscape, I would say, with a lot going on. But it, was it the whole, who knows? Who knows what was really going on back in the past or where it was originally connected? I didn't see much of the old world buildings in Florida myself. It all seemed very brand new laid ground, utilitarian over beauty more than anything. Very modern, technology based type of cityscape is all I really saw there. So maybe I didn't get the true flavor
it's
of
not
what's.
very pretty,
No, it wasn't
but
very pretty, no.
there's a few buildings, but you have to you have to be looking for it. And I've just now recently started noticing more and more, like, even shopping complexes that are these huge brick with domes on top, and they've turned it into like a Macy's and stuff. And it's like, no, that wasn't built to be a Macy's,
Now you mentioned that, actually, in England, I live near Manchester, and we have this Manchester shopping centre, and it's quite big. It's a big hub most people in the northwest go to for shopping, and they have like giant marble pillars all throughout this thing, literal marble staircases ingrained with golden handles and all these type of things, and like they have like statues of like angels just. All around the rim of the edge of this, you have golden angels and all these type of things. And they say, I think it did you say it was built quite modern? So maybe this is not at all what I'm thinking of, but it seems like maybe they were attempting to recreate something like a cathedral style when they built it. I don't know, but maybe this is another example of it's actually a lot older. Maybe parts of it are a lot older than we think, and they've kind of renovated it into this place of commercialism and like restaurants and all this sort of stuff. Who knows? Who knows? Just got me thinking there for a second because you just reminded me. Oh yeah, but I have a shopping mall just like that is what I thought when you said it. But I don't
I think
know.
they've
I don't know.
renovated for sure. Absolutely. Some of these buildings, I don't think they were built for what they are now in the businesses that reside in them.
No.
It doesn't make sense. But the only other thing I really had for today was, which I had messaged you about, was a lot of people or a lot of Christians on this theory tend to hold back that some of these cathedrals were millennial reign architecture because they're in many of them venerating what we're told is, Mary, the mother of Jesus. And you can tell these aren't really additions. Some of them are, in the dome paintings or, part of the marble structure. And these are in a lot of these cathedral buildings, as if they've made worshiping Mary or venerating Mary. I'm not really sure which. I don't know much about Catholicism, but I know that, those depictions are in all of these. And I think it's pretty clear in Revelation chapter 12 that the woman with the 12 stars around her head is the remnant of Israel that was faithful, the faithful Israel. And even talks about her hiding in the wilderness during the 1260 days, which we know from Daniel and from other parts that that was the 3.5 year, that had been the Jewish Roman War, the tribulation, Jacob's trouble, whatever you want to call it. But God protected, his faithful remnant of Israel. And that is how that's described in the book of Revelation of what that represents, is, the 12 tribes of Israel, but the faithful portion, because we know the unfaithful portion is characterized as the harlot. So in these churches, I noticed a lot of these depictions where it looked like angels or even Jesus himself was crowning this woman in blue with 12 stars around her head, and she looks beautiful. And they're putting a crown on her head, I guess a crown of glory, in a lot of these depictions. And so I was thinking, well, why would they be venerating Mary so much? I mean, sure, she, did birth the Messiah, but if these were truly built during the millennial reign, what is the purpose of why these are almost in every cathedral? But then when I read one of the, actually was able to translate one of the Latin inscriptions around one of these depictions, it was very clear that this was the faithful Israel who was now the bride of Christ. And so that's why she's being crowned. I mean, as far as the covenants go, we know that apostate, which I can never say that word, Israel was, divorced by God, by Yahweh during the tribulation. It was the end of the Mosaic covenant. He divorced her for being the harlot, for committing adultery with the beast. And then we have the marriage supper of the Lamb and the new bride of Christ. So he's divorcing the old bride, the unfaithful Israel, and he's remarrying the new bride, which started with the faithful Israel. Now, of course, the whole church, and they even say New Jerusalem are also, it's all encompassing the bride of Christ. But it makes more sense in these depictions that show that why she's being crowned and why she's depicted this depiction of this woman in blue with the 12 stars is depicting with Jesus in so many different ways is that that is the new bride of Christ. And again, they talk about the marriage supper of the Lamb under the new covenant. So I think that that kind of analogy just helps to understand why that would be there.
It's an interesting take, isn't it? Because obviously people have always assumed, oh, well, that's the mother, that's Mary, the Virgin Mary. It's the mother of Jesus, and icon worship in Catholicism and Orthodoxy is this idea that, you venerate those who are saints, and obviously those of important value to the bringing of Christ into the world. And it could be, like you said, that's just a completely Catholic inversion of what's really going on here. I suppose a cover up in a sense that's a symbolic representation of the Bride of Christ. And like I said, the 12 stars or the 12 tribes. It's an interesting take. And I don't know if I've ever heard that one before you mentioned it. I'm not sure how people in the chat are going to react to that. Someone's already said Ishtar Semiramis and just left it at that. So I'm guessing some people aren't really taking it. But
Sorry to cause a riot.
yeah,
It
maybe.
didn't even dawn on me until I translated that Latin inscription around it in one of the buildings, and I'd have to find it now. But that was the first time it really dawned on me because it was a quote from Revelation 12, and I was like, they tell us that it's Mary. But I don't believe it is based on the scripture, and based on the evidence. But yeah, I know a lot of people won't take that well.
No, interesting take. And again, that's what we've got to do now. We've got to reevaluate and reinterpret many of the things that we have been told about what these symbols represent and what they mean. Maybe we need to start looking into who's holding the baby Jesus as well, and all those. Is that also the 12 tribes, maybe? Because you see baby Jesus often being held by a woman, don't you? And he's like a man baby, though. He's like a baby who's like sat up straight holding a scepter, pointing at you like that. And it's kind of, I don't know. Maybe they're the later additions to try and back up that idea of, it represents the mother of, Jesus. It's the Virgin Mary. Maybe those are the
Right.
later additions and corruptions. Who
Well, I
knows?
think Israel's whole, I mean, based on the Abrahamic covenant, the whole deal was that they were supposed to bring forth the Messiah. So Israel technically did. Mary was a portion of that. So I think it works both ways. Israel did their part, even though it didn't go great the whole time throughout the Old Testament, they came through and they brought forth the Messiah, which was to bless all the nations. And that was the end of the Abrahamic covenant. So I think it works either way.
Maybe we need to see if there's any differences between the woman who birthed Christ and Christ's bride. Maybe they have a different color or something. Maybe start doing comparative analysis on these
That's
women
a good thought.
representations. Who knows? Just to see if there is anything we can piece together. This is all brand new. I think people are quite forgiving on this channel because we're just trying to figure it out for the first time, really.
Right.
This is new stuff, And I see that do you have a podcast, biblically based?
I'm starting a podcast. I've been working, doing a lot of research. It's been a little slow in the making just because I have a toddler at home.
I understand. I'm about to have a second one. Yeah, so I understand it's difficult, but I recommend you do get your podcast on the go. It seems like you've got a lot of work to do, a lot of research to share. There's no time like the present, Find when next time the toddler's asleep, do what you're doing now and record yourself speaking and do some presentations. I'd recommend it. And maybe this is our chance to get people to go over and subscribe. Where can they find you? Go on, you give your information And then I'm gonna have to get the next caller on.
YouTube. I have the channel up. Nothing posted yet, but I'm working on it and hoping to get something up very soon. But you can find me on YouTube.
Perfect. Send me the link in Telegram. I'll put it into the description of this video. But I'm going to have to leave that there now. Thanks for coming on. It's been interesting. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. And I'm going to see if Chris wants to join me now. So God bless. Thanks for joining
me.
Thank
you, Paul. It was a pleasure.
No problem. So there we go, guys. Wasn't that interesting? That was a different take. I've never really heard that concept about the woman before. I thought that was really interesting. And the idea that all the saints pretty much just look identical no matter where you go to any cathedral. That's another valid point, isn't it, that can help us kind of piece this together. So I'm just going to get the invite link for this new meeting here. And I'm going to send that to Chris in the email. I don't have a streamlined process of doing this, guys. I'm not a professional. I'm a fraud. That's all I can really say when it comes to calling shows. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm winging it here. But let me just quickly change the webcam so you don't see all the behind the scenes stuff. There we go. But that was interesting. I enjoyed that a lot. And maybe we do have to start looking at these examples of the woman in church frescoes and so forth. The one being crowned by Jesus and the one holding baby Jesus is quite interesting. Maybe there are color differences or something we can look to. I'm just checking my emails here, see if Chris does want to join me. Let me just check if he sent anything new. I've got an email about not using Zoom anymore or something. Someone wants to pitch me a business deal about an alternative platform for meeting and having conversations like this that doesn't involve Zoom. George, I'm going to tell you right now, I've already paid for a year's subscription of Zoom and I'm about 3 months into it. So I'm going to get my money's worth before I convert to anything else. But I'm interested, George. You let me know what your alternative to Zoom platform is that you're seem to be making yourself. But Chris, if you are listening, I'm going to send you the link now in an email. And if you want to join by clicking that link, you can come on and share your ideas surrounding the Millennial Kingdom, but I'm going to have to keep it relatively quick. I've got about half an hour spare, maybe a bit less, but the link has been sent to you. You join that Zoom conversation and we can crack on. So let me check the chat in the meantime. Alex, Ross and Paul, has baby arrived? No, he has not arrived yet. I think my wife wishes that he would because, you know, it's painful being pregnant, but... not yet. He's due on the 28th of December, but I have the feeling he's going to come a lot earlier than that. Our first son was 36 weeks, so I assume our second child will be maybe something similar, maybe just on 37 weeks, but any minute now, it could happen. My wife could knock on this door and say, Paul, pack up, we're going to the hospital, and I'd be like, okay, see you in a bit, guys. Sorry, Chris, it's not happening, and I'd be off straight away. But who knows? Exciting, isn't it? Who knows? Anything could happen. Leaving Babylon's here. Madeline's here. Great. She says the bride makes sense in some of the depictions. Yeah. Yeah. But it's just, again, it's an interesting idea that was shared there. So maybe we can start looking into that, you know, get a bit deeper. Maybe I'll invite her back on and maybe we can flesh this out together. It is her idea after all. So we'll have to, we've got to work together on this and keep it fair, haven't we? Pearlmeyer says, I like Nicolette. I'll have to subscribe. Yep. There we go. Biblically based podcast. Biblically based podcast, I think it was called. The Genesis flood was pre-millennial rain in the time of Noah, which gives us the geological and fossil record, says Misty Blue. Yes, you do find there's a lot of that people trying to say, and I guess you were responding to somebody who was saying something similar. This idea that, oh no, all these old world buildings that you're seeing were created by the Nephilim before the flood of Noah, and they're only buried because of the flood of Noah. And I'm like, that was like 4,000 years ago. These buildings wouldn't have made it that far. Like, why, in your effort to not let it be the Millennial Kingdom or the mud flood of the release of Satan or whatever we want to do, you've somehow rationalized that these buildings have lasted 5,000 years after a global, earth-wide deluge. And I'm like, that rationale is extremely flawed. These buildings aren't that old when you look at them. Weathering is a real thing you can follow and watch. and they haven't been that weathered, especially not from a worldwide deluge. So I just don't understand why people leaped to that conclusion. It must be some kind of way that's trying to justify in their mind how these buildings got buried. That doesn't mean the Millennial Kingdom has happened. But you're talking ancient past here when you're talking about the flood of Noah. This is something else. Whatever happened to these things that buried them is a result of something else, something more recent. And we can tell that because of the condition of the buildings. It was recent. No, just checking the chat there. The chat's kind of gone away from me a little bit. Misty Blue says she went 42 weeks except the last one. Whew. I'm sorry to hear that. I bet that was a nightmare. I lived in Florida 30 years, but still have my New York accent, says Mr. Terrible. Good for you. They're all cults. Okay, fair enough. I don't know what that means. If you look at World War II videos from the failed artist, the buildings already look ancient. Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame that what happened to Dresden, isn't it? Absolute shame. End of the day, can't trust the mainstream scientists, etc. That's true. Let's check this Zoom if anyone's... So Chris, do you not want to join me? Have you changed your mind? Have you gone back on what you wanted there? You seem quite eager originally. Your email seemed to be full of information you wanted to share with me. Like I said, if you're listening, Chris, I have sent you the link in your email. I've responded to your email with the link. Click it and come and join me on Zoom and let's have a conversation. I'll give you 3.5 more minutes. Once I hit 10 minutes with this Zoom call, I'm going to have to move on and see if anyone else wants to do it instead. Anyone else who's interested in coming on and having a conversation, let me know. Send me a message. Let's see. And obviously give me a brief description of what it is you want to talk about, just so I know where we can lead the conversation or if I can pull up anything I want to say. It looks like Nicolette from Biblically Based has sent me her link. So I'm going to post that in the chat for anyone who wants to go and follow her. There we go. And I will pin that for now. So you can go and follow Biblically Based there for you guys, just to keeping it fresh. And let me just check the Zoom. Still no Chris. Come on, Chris, you've got two minutes, 35 seconds to get in here. Well, I'm going to have to close it down. But yeah, send me an email at understandingconspiracy@gmail.com if you would like to come on and be a caller in today's live Q&A session. Let's keep it about the Millennial Kingdom. Let's keep it on topic, guys, and let's not veer off too much. It's too easy. While I am waiting, I may as well advertise. I just did this earlier. I'll just show the email, I guess, because it's easy because I've already got up on screen. But if you're a patron member, but you're a free patron member, why not consider joining up today and maybe for a year, or maybe if you want to do just the month, the first month or the first full year is currently 20% off with this code here, AA458. You can get your membership for 1 month for 20% off, or for the full year if you pay for a yearly membership on Patreon. 20% off, holiday season special. It's running up until the 31st of December, so you can get yourself 20% off your membership over at Patreon and get access to all the behind the scenes extra stuff, early access stuff. You will often see there's about 3 or 4 podcasts on there which are not currently available on YouTube or anywhere, which you can go and check out before I release them onto my platform. So there you go, guys. Go and check that out, that offer for yourself there while I'm waiting. And I'm just going to have a quick drink. So I am also going to leave you with another advert, the Christmas advert for my book for 2.5 minutes while I see if Chris wants to join me. So enjoy. This Saturnalia, imagine a world where the truth was accessible and relatable. Where red baubles on a Nimrod phallus are forever changed. A solstice celebration where conspiracy and intrigue carry you away. Experience the Nephilim looked like clowns, The perfect book for your weird way of life. Direct from Europe, this highly rated research has warmed the hearts of millions in time for the frosty season. Be inspired by timeless biblical questions such as, what the hell is Satan's problem? Ham did what to Noah? Was the pre-flood world really that bad? And if classic questions aren't your thing, and you prefer your Yuletide to be extra occult, take a trip to the unknown with the spine-chilling Hatman to the psychedelic realm of demonic jesters. You'll get 20 obscure and tantalizing chapters. No other book gives you the feeling of pure vindication towards your childhood fear of clowns. Each paragraph brings the wonder of Christ's sacrifice into your home. For this commercialized nonsense holiday, there's no greater gift for your family than a guide to effective spiritual warfare. Order now and get that edgelord of a teenage child of yours to Christ this winter. Sometimes in this little season, it takes clowns to get them there. To get your copy, do not call the number on screen, which is being used as a placeholder reminder of a bygone time. And don't send a check to any P.O. box, because this is not the 90s anymore. Simply type in "The Nephilim Look Like Clowns" on Amazon to get your copy just in time to lock yourself away from the world and wait out the pagan festivities. And I am back. Chris has lost his chance. I've closed that Zoom call. I can't wait any longer. And if you guys can't actually tell, I am in excruciating pain. I have an incredibly sore throat. My wisdom tooth is fully flared up. I've got this lump thing going on down here you get sometimes. I am flustered and flushed. I am not well. It's my own fault. My diet has been terrible recently. And it's the terrain. It's not the germs or the viruses. So I am actually in the middle of a fast currently. I have been fasting for 12 hours already. I stopped eating today at 11 a.m. because I just could feel I needed to do it. And I'm going to go sleep, hopefully for another 12 hours. Have a full 24-hour fast going there. I'm drinking water nonstop, doing everything I can to try and get this thing fixed and out of me, because I am just not in the mood to be under the weather. So I don't know how much longer I can actually go, guys. If I might be overdoing it a little bit and actually damage my throat if I do go for much longer. Maybe I'll go for 10 minutes. Maybe. Let's make this maybe 1 hour 45 today. It's 1 hour 36 I've been going for. Well, let me know any questions in the chat, and I'll try my best to answer some of your questions in the meantime. Let's keep them cool. No, let's keep them cool. I'm not looking to argue today. Visionary Vet says, I love the 40s style of the advert. Well, I was actually going for 90s CD commercial style, but I'll take 40s style. That's fine with me. I was actually going to do an interview before this show with Joe, JT Vollers JC. A bit of a behind the scenes stuff here, but he's working on something, a project. A part two project, a documentary style thing, and he wanted me to be on there talking about the Nephilim clowns, and I was like, Joe, I'm gonna have to cancel on you and push this to Friday. I'm a mess. There's no way I'm gonna be on a documentary sounding like an absolute, not like this. Don't let it be like this, please. So I pushed that forward to Friday, and I thought I'd save my voice for this one show with you guys instead. Sore throats. Strep throat is the worst. I don't know if it's strep or something. I don't know what it is. I think my wisdom tooth flared up, which caused a bacteria problem, which then caused the rest of my throat to kind of go haywire, my tonsils to get messed up. And I think the infection's kind of just spread further down since then, as the day's gone on. I need to get more sleep. I've not been sleeping enough lately. I've been burning the candle at both ends, as they say, trying to prepare for the baby and also do work and earn money and be self-employed and write a book and everything else. It's hard. It's hard to do everything and, you know, keep your head afloat when you're self-employed. You never really have a day off or time to yourself where you're not thinking about work. So I've been doing a lot of late nights, planning and organizing and writing and all sorts of things. So I think maybe it's all just caught up with me. So I've been stress eating as a result, and I've gained weight. I'm like 14 stone and I'm 5'7". Like, that's not good. My BMI is through the roof. I need to get back down to a healthy 12 to 13 stone, roughly somewhere around there where I usually am at my peak. I can feel it. I can feel the weight bringing me down, you know. So I'm gonna start the intermittent fasting regime again. I'm gonna sort it out, and hopefully I'll get better for this winter season as well. Paul, are you ever going to get your wisdom teeth removed? I was on a list to get it done, but I never the pain subsided, so I've not bothered getting it done. Then I hear stories about getting your wisdom teeth. It's not actually a good thing because you need your wisdom teeth for things, and it's kind of a minor growing sideways or something. I don't know. Typical British teeth, you know, they're just wonky and all over the place and terrible. I got fillings galore. I feel like I'd rather just have them all removed and get fake teeth and just be done with it. Just to stop tooth pain, you know. But I don't know. Maybe one day I'll get them removed. But this is the thing, when they're not hurting, you don't care about them because you don't feel them, so they're not an issue. So you forget about getting them removed. And then when they flare up, you're like, why didn't I get the damn things removed? It's just an endless cycle, isn't it? You never win. My phone went off there. I've got an email. Let me just read this quickly to myself before I read it to you. Have you ever done any research on the fasces weapon? There is a reason why the US Congress has it on their coat of arms. Yes, the fasces, the bundle of sticks with like a, what looks like an axe head sticking out of it of some kind. I remember a long time ago, even before the old world stuff, I think I remember people talking about the fasces is actually a frequency weapon of sorts. It's an example of a type of weapon that can bring down buildings quite easily through vibration and frequency. It's more of a sound cannon than it is an actual axe. There's no axe which should actually be shaped like that. You know, no practical axe is useful shaped like the fasces. So yes, I've heard of that one. Thanks for the question. That's all I really understand about it, that it possibly is an example of a secret weapon, which has been, or knowledge that's been passed down that people know about, which can be used as a frequency weapon to change the tide of any war or civilization, to be honest. Something like that. And those who hold the power of the fascists have truly ruled the world. It's that type of thing. I think it's not a weapon everybody can have necessarily. Maybe there's only one, and whoever possesses it gets the chance to use it and is feared by all. I don't know. Or maybe it's a form of technology everybody could back engineer and have, so whoever has it covets it to make sure no one else gets a hold of the same technology or something like that. It's mysterious. It's a mysterious thing. It's a mysterious symbol. And yes, it is often shown on the American iconography all over the place. And Nazi iconography as well, I think, if I remember correctly. Have you ever looked into Havana syndrome? I've not, and I couldn't give you an opinion on it right now, Mr. Terrell, but I will now you've mentioned it. Oh, God. Well, that's a horrible story. I guess I won't be getting my wisdom teeth removed anytime soon. Thanks for that. So I got mine removed after hearing about that. Oh, right. Oh, yeah, the pressure gets so bad that it broke everything. That's awful. So maybe I should be getting it removed is what I should have said there. Yeah, it's... I think there is room, but mine's grown in a bad angle that it's kind of cutting everything up all the time, and that's the issue. So it flares up like every month or two. I do need to get them removed for my own sanity and pain. In fact, I bought some oil for this specifically. Is it clove oil or something? I can't remember which one it is. But I do have downstairs a specific oil I bought for this months ago that I've just reminded myself about it, that I said I would use next time this happens. So after this show, I'm going to go downstairs, I'm going to get it out of the medicine box where I left it. I'm going to use that. Is it clove oil? It's some kind of oil people put on the teeth, their wisdom tooth, to stop the pain. It's like a natural remedy. Someone's going to say it in the chat eventually, I don't know, but I've got some downstairs. I'm going to have to go use it. Like a hail cannon, says Margaret. I guess so, the fascists. I don't know, really. I'm not sure. They can blaspheme the Holy Ghost all they want, baby. Let's see where it lands them. It ain't my issue, you know? I don't know what that means. I don't know, Panson. I don't know. Drop the seed oil if you want to be healthy. Drop the seed oil if you want to be healthy. I don't use seed oil. I use vegetable oil, which probably isn't any better, to be honest, because of nightshade and the rest. But no, I'm not a seed oil person. Clove, bro, clove oil. Yeah, I've got clove oil downstairs. I bought it specifically for this. Yeah, I'm going to go use it after this and see if it helps. It'll be the first time I've ever used it on my wisdom tooth pain. And I guess I was just waiting for it to flare up again to have an opportunity to use it. So here's my opportunity. Completely forgot I even had it there. So I'm going to give that a go. I did use cloves in my black walnut husk tincture with garlic and wormwood for the parasite cleanse. So I'm guessing it's going to taste as awful as that did. We'll see. I don't know. Clove oil, but don't let it touch anything you don't want set to be numb, says Miner. Okay, well, when it's in your mouth, you can't help but have it spread everywhere and numb everything. It's like there's nothing you can do about that. So if it's going to get numb, it's going to get numb, you know. The millennial reign was the end of a battle in a war that is still going on, and it is going on because most of the world is fascinated with Christ and kickball. Okay, real Kasadar, I don't know what you just said. I don't feel like it was as deep as you think it was, though, but thanks for saying it. Vegetable oil is an artificial name for seed oil, says Haha. Well, there you go, I've been schooled. Okay, I'll cut it out. On your behest, because you said so, I'm going to completely cut that out of my diet from now on. What is a stone? Says Naomi Singleton. Well, you know, it seems like most stone is petrified wood or flesh of some kind that has become scattered. It's petrified organic matter. That seems to be what stone is. And it doesn't take long for organic matter to petrify either. Or it doesn't take wild conditions for it to happen either. It's quite interesting. It's a natural anesthetic and antibacterial. It does taste awful though. Yeah, I thought it would, Mariska. I thought it would taste awful. I'm prepared for that inevitability. I got a numb tongue. Yeah. We're in the short season, if anything. So there we go, guys. I'm gonna call this a night. It's 1 hour, 45 minutes, roughly, we've been going for, which is a good amount of time for a sick person like me, someone who's under the weather and ill. The headache's starting to kick in. The beaming lights are starting to give me like a migraine effect. So I'm going to call it a night. I hope you enjoyed the two guests. Thanks to Andy and Nicoletta. Great talk, great information. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Some new stuff to think about and some ideas to chew on there. You can go and follow Nicoletta's podcast by following the link that's pinned in the chat there. I'll make sure to put it in the description of this as well. Sweet, short and sweet. I might do another call in again soon. Let me know if you guys like this type of thing. If you want to come in and talk, send me an email and we'll arrange a date where you can come on and do your thing. You don't have to be an expert at anything. You don't have to have your own channel. You just have to have the confidence to get up here and just speak your mind. I'm here to give you a platform to do that if you want to. As long as you don't say something absolutely stupid that will complete and totally destroy my channel and get me banned instantly, you all know what topics those are. So come on, this is YouTube, guys. Keep it real. Other than that caveat and warning, thanks for being here, guys. Thanks for listening. And as always, God bless.